You may be familiar with the name Buckwhaley, possibly because there was once a nightclub on Leeson Street in Dublin that bore his name, which had absolutely nothing whatever to do with him. But you may not know that much about him. Well, he was a man who led an extraordinary life, known equally for his adventuring, his huge gambling debts, and a perilous journey that he undertook to Jerusalem and back to Ireland within a year, a serious undertaking in the 18th century. There's a new book out, Buckwhaley, Ireland's Greatest Adventurer. It tells the full story of his remarkable life and adventures for the first time. And the author, David Ryan, joins me now in studio. David, you're very welcome.
Thanks very much, Miles.
Just give us a quick overview. Give us the kind of the bullet points before we get into this in any detail of the life and times of Buckwhaley.
Sure. Well, Buckwhaley was a very wealthy young Anglo-Irish gentleman who lived during the late 18th century, born in Dublin. In 1765, and he lived until 1800, so he was 34 when he died. And like many wealthy young gentlemen at the time, he was much given to gambling and self-indulgence and all that kind of carry on. And if he had only been that, and if he'd only done that, we probably wouldn't know too much about him today. But the extraordinary thing about him is that he, in 1788, he embarked for Jerusalem on the back of a £15,000 wager. And he travelled there and back within a year in order to successfully win his bet.
We'll talk about that in more detail in a few minutes. But he was born into wealth and privilege, wasn't he?
He was born into great wealth and privilege, yes. He inherited from his father, Richard Chappell Whaley, he inherited a lump sum of circa £50,000 to £60,000 in their money, which equates to probably something in between 10 and 20 million in today's money. And he also inherited estates in County Carlow.
But he inherited those at a very, very early age. I mean, he didn't come into it until he was, what, 21?
Yeah, he didn't come into it until he was 21, but he inherited it when he was around 10 or thereabouts. But even though he didn't technically come into the inheritance until the age of 21, at a much earlier age than that, he was able to borrow heavily on the back of the fact that he was going to come into all this cash.
So he could begin his life as a rake at a very, very early age.
Very early age.
Tell us a bit more about his trip to Jerusalem. I mean, a £15,000 bet, given that he had inherited something like four times that, which amounts to about 20 million. That's a lot of money. That's a hell of a bet.
Yeah, it is. It's again, it's probably something in the region of a few million in today's money, you know, and it was accumulation of debts that other some of his friends and acquaintances around Dublin, but also people further afield had made with him as to whether.
So it wasn't just one person. It was a number of people.
It was indeed, yeah, a number of people. There was a well-known club at the time in Dublin called Daly's Club. A lot of MPs who would have been in Parliament in the Parliament House of College Green, which is now the Bank of Ireland building. A lot of the MPs would have been patrons of Daly's Club, as Buckwhaley was himself. And many of these people bet with him, but also other individuals
and
as well.
And why was it a big deal in that period to go to Jerusalem and to come back again?
Yeah, sure. So if you or I want to go to Jerusalem, Miles, we go on to Expedia.com or Ryanair, whoever it may be, and we book ourselves a flight. But in the 18th century, it's decidedly more complicated than this. You have to travel by sea or by land, and going by sea or by land to the Middle East in the 18th century was an extremely complicated undertaking. By sea...
Not just logistics. Complicated, I presume. It was dangerous as well.
It was very dangerous because you know, it's a long journey by sea. It took him 3 weeks to sail from Dublin and then to London, and from London on to Turkey. It took him well over 3 weeks, actually. But also, you could be shipwrecked easily. There were many storms and hurricanes, and you could also be attacked by pirates, or you could be attacked by the hostile fleets of enemy powers. Then, when you got to land, Jerusalem obviously is inland. You have to travel overland for a certain period of time. You could be subject to not only the vagaries of the weather and abysmal accommodation, because that was always was all that was available. I mean,
wasn't a tourist trap in those days.
Not in those days, no. You know, you could. It wasn't set up for travel, let alone tourism. So, you know, you could end up in some whatever roadside stable or shack served the purpose.
And God knows what you could catch.
I beg your pardon?
God knows what you could catch, what disease you could catch.
Exactly. And he did, as it happened, fall ill with a fever when he was in Constantinople, which, as people will know, is now Istanbul. He fell ill with a fever that almost killed him, actually, when he was kind of halfway through his expedition. So,
and how do you prove that you've been to Jerusalem and that you have come back again? I mean, he could have just gone to London, lost a few bob on the gambling tables and come back to Dublin and say, yeah, I was there.
Sure, yeah. And of course, he had no social media or GPS or anything to track where he was. So, the way he proved it was there were a number of Christian convents in the Holy Land at that time. There still are, actually, in Jerusalem and Nazareth and places like this. And even though it was under Muslim dominion, the dominion of the Ottoman Empire at the time, the Sultan had given these Christian convents permission to still operate in the Holy Land. And the one in Jerusalem and the one in Nazareth both issued certificates proving that he had been in Jerusalem and in Nazareth on those dates in 1789.
There are lots of myths about Bokwaili. One of them is, there's a celebrated myth about Bokwaili and the Wailing Wall. Tell us about that.
Yes, this one, people familiar with old histories of Dublin might have come across it. It's the idea that not only did he travel to Jerusalem, but that he walked there overland, except insofar as it was necessary to go across the sea, which happens to be nonsense, actually. He sailed most of the way. But the other myth is that he played handball against the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, which I would say if you went along there today and tried it, you probably wouldn't get very far.
But I hope not.
That is a complete myth. There's no mention of it, not only in his own memoirs, but in the journal of his travelling companion, Hugh Moore, which is also still extant. It's actually in a private collection in Istanbul. He makes no mention of it either, so it was concocted, I think, in later years to...
One thing that is not a myth, and which is almost as extraordinary as the notion of playing handball against the Wailing Wall in Jerusalem, was he had a plan to save King Louis the 16th from the guillotine.
That's right. Whaley racked up quite a few debts and had to clear off to France around 1791 and got caught up in the affairs of the French Revolution. And he was in the city early in 1793 when King Louis the 16th had been tried, found guilty of conspiring against the state and was sentenced to be executed by guillotine. And Whaley came up with a harebrained scheme, not his only harebrained scheme, but possibly one of the more famous ones, that he was going to rescue him from the guillotine. And when he got to the Place de la Révolution, which is the Place de la Concorde now with the big obelisk in Paris, he realised that rows of red, blue coated soldiers were surrounding the scaffold, that there wasn't a chance he could break through and spirit the king to safety. And he ran off in horror from the scene and found himself in a coffee house where he recorded his feelings at the time, which were incidentally accentuated by the fact that a bunch of Englishmen burst in, covered in the king's blood with bits of the king's hair and all sorts of things, which they... being ardent revolutionaries, obviously caught up in the enthusiasm of it, and they were showing off as trophies.
He was an MP, and he was an Irish MP. Now, you know, that's nothing spectacular there, because pretty much every wealthy Anglo-Irishman or member of any Anglo-Irish family in those days became an MP at some stage. But he was an MP.
Yeah, he was an MP. But as you say, it wasn't necessarily indicative of a great interest in politics.
He was no Henry Grattan.
Certainly not, no. And like a number of other young MPs, it was kind of, they became MPs for the privilege that the position afforded them, but they were more interested in spending their time drinking, gambling, you know, bit of womanising. And incidentally, it was with a number of those other MPs that he kind of hung out in Daly's Club. And these were some of the guys that bet with him whether or not he could travel to Jerusalem.
Tell us about his relationship with a land agent called Samuel Faulkner. Why is that significant?
It's very significant for the fact, given the fact that Faulkner filed away every letter he had he received concerning Whaley and Whaley's estates, because Faulkner was Whaley's land agent, but he was also the man to whom Whaley turned every time he got heavily into debt or got into some kind of scrape and needed help to get out of it.
And Faulkner kept all this stuff.
It's now,
you must be a big fan of Faulkner.
Well, if it wasn't for Faulkner, we wouldn't know a hell of a lot about Whaley today. And I was lucky enough to get access to the private collection where it's held, and I'm very grateful to the owners for letting me look at it. And it allowed us to fill in a lot of the gaps in Whaley's life.
How did he die?
He died in what some believe to be controversial circumstances, but he was undertaking a journey from Liverpool to London in the year 1800 when something happened on the road, and he was taken in an expiring state. He was brought to a nearby inn on the Mail Court Road called the Georgian, I think, in Knutsford, which is in Cheshire. And it seems that he had caught a fever. He'd always been kind of susceptible to feverish illness, which has struck him down a couple of times during his life, and he died there and then the spot. But the interesting thing was that about 20 years later, a story emerged that actually it wasn't fever that killed him at all, that was just invented to cover up the actual really controversial circumstances of his demise, which were that he had been stabbed by one of his mistresses. Now, as far as I've investigated that particular story, as far as I can make out, it's a fabrication, but it's no surprise that controversy was surround Whaley's death when it was something that kind of dogged him all his life.
Mm. And he had numerous children, or he had at least three children. Were they all from the same well, it wasn't wife, because I think the person to whom he was married wasn't the mother of those children. So he got around.
Correct, yes. He had five children in total.
Five, sorry. Okay.
Four with the same lady. But the first one he had during his travels in France on his grand tour when he was quite young, actually, only 17 or 18, he got a local noblewoman pregnant, and the daughter actually died soon afterwards. And then in later years, he took up with a lady called Maria Courtney and had four children with her, but they were not married either. He did marry eventually, about 10 months before his death in 1800, but that marriage in that short time didn't produce any children.
But it did produce deaths, and unfortunately, I think people were still pursuing his unfortunate widow for payment of those debts after he died.
Correct, yeah. Before his death, he had managed to... partly by gambling, but partly also by a clever way of playing the political game. He had become an MP again and was back in the Irish Parliament, and he took bribes to vote both for and against the Union, the Act of Union, as people will know, to unify Britain and Ireland after the 1798 rebellion. He made a bit of money that way. He also made a bit of money from his new wife's inheritance. But despite all that, his affairs were in a very muddled state and he left extensive debts behind him.
Okay, in six or seven figures, very quickly, put a figure on it. Do you have any idea how much money he went through in his lifetime?
He himself puts it at £400,000, which is possibly an exaggeration, but from what I have been able to discover from the sources, I would say that it was probably between 200,000 and 400,000, which is still an astronomical amount.
It's about 40, 50 million, isn't it?
It would be between 50 and 100 million in today's money.
Okay, right. Thank you very much. The book is called Buck Whaley, Ireland's Greatest Adventure, published by Merrion Press. The author is David Ryan. Thank you for joining us on the programme today, David. That's all we've got time for. Details of all items, as well as podcasts, available on our website, rte.ie/history. Thanks tonight to Noel Robertson Sand and our researcher, Liz Gillis. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.
Follow us on Twitter at RTE History Show.